History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they really don't have to, because that's where we come in. Taking the initiative to ask a few questions and investing some time to listen can make a bigger difference than I think we realize. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. This weekend finds us in the midst of some significant dates on the calendar. August 6th was the 80th anniversary of the first atomic bomb, a devastating and world-changing moment that also prevented millions of lives from being added to the catastrophic losses of World War II. August 9th was when the second bomb hit Nagasaki, and the last living member of the squadron that deployed those weapons is someone you've heard from on this show. In fact, we revisited all of that recently when Norris Jernigan turned 100. I had the privilege of spending some time with Norris last week, not to mention a few other special veterans in California's Central Valley. I want to thank the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Fresno State for giving us a platform to share their stories. I've got a link to that whole presentation for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And I also want to give you a heads up for another anniversary. Thursday, August 14th, will mark the 80th anniversary of VJ Day, when finally that worldwide war was over. There will be a special ceremony that day at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can register online to attend in person, or you can follow the live stream. And that will actually conclude a two-day lecture series that you can also attend physically or virtually. You can find that link at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. But today, we're going to focus on something that might have slipped by you this week, a day that, if it isn't marked on your calendar now, maybe it should be. A few of the over 1,000 World War II veterans I've had the privilege of interviewing over the years have been honored at the White House. Which party is occupying the White House is immaterial. And you've heard clips from both Republican presidents and Democrat presidents. On this past Thursday, August 7th, nearly 100 military men and women who have paid a significant price for our freedom were honored at the White House. And here's why.
Even more importantly, this is also National Purple Heart Day. And we're here to honor and celebrate the unyielding patriotism and grit and devotion to America's Purple Heart veterans is great emotion and great love. The Purple Heart dates back to August 7th, 1782. That's a long time, when General George Washington awarded a heart-shaped purple cloth to three soldiers for outstanding gallantry and service in battle. This afternoon, we're joined by dozens of Purple Heart recipients and their families, and just as General Washington did 243 years ago, today we give our everlasting thanks to you and your unbelievable families. We want to thank you very much for being here. It's my pleasure.
The president highlighted the stories of a few of those Purple Heart recipients in the room before highlighting a reality that knows no party line. And if you'll indulge me with this opportunity to share a little perspective from 20 years of interviewing World War II vets, there's a recurring theme that's really been impossible to miss. So many from that generation have shared the incredible unity that existed in World War II. And they've longed to see that kind of unity return. What I've witnessed is that the opportunity to honor those who have served is something that actually has the power to unite us again. After all, the enemy never asked for someone's name, age, ethnicity, bank account, political persuasion, or religious belief before launching a rocket or firing a shell. Americans from all categories have bled and died for the freedom we enjoy. Here's another brief excerpt from the president on National Purple Heart Day.
Every Purple Heart tells a story of courage, sacrifice, and purpose. It speaks of a price paid for the soldier beside you, the country behind you, and the generations of Americans yet to come. And we have some great generations to follow. It's going to happen. Those who wear this medal ran into bullets, faced ferocious bombs, and shed their blood on the field of battle. We will never forget what they did. We will always use them as an example of bravery and courage and strength. And we will also always think, when we look at them, of our great American flag. We want our great American flag to be strong, and it's stronger than ever. From the very beginning, our nation's fate has depended on heroes like those in the room who placed their bodies between the enemy fire and really that fire and the American freedom that we all love so much. Because of their sacrifice today, our flag is still waving proudly, and our freedom is still safe and secure, and our future is looking brighter and greater than ever.
Part of the thought behind this program has always been that we have a better chance at a better future if we understand the past, and that we'll value our freedom more if we can comprehend how great a price has been paid. So in honor of National Purple Heart Day, we're going to spend the rest of our time listening to the stories of men who earned that medal. Three men from three different branches of service, but all among the nearly 2 million Americans who have been awarded the Purple Heart over the last century. We're going to start with a Marine from Philadelphia, Francis O'Brien.
We're going to the Marshall Islands at a place called Kwajalein, which was the largest island-enclosed portion of the lagoon in the Pacific Ocean. One end of the lagoon was Kwajalein. At the other end of the island was a place called Roy and Namur. And it was R-O-I for Roy and Namur, N-A-M-U-R. And we were going to land on Namur. And our lieutenant said, you know, tomorrow we're going to land on Namur. There are about 2,500 Japanese there. We're going to land with about 2,500 men. And in 24 hours, it is either ours or we're all dead. And that was the pep talk.
That's encouraging, isn't it?
Very encouraging. So we're supposed to land by LVTs, which are landing vehicle tractor. They had problems before with Tarawa, where the landing boats got hung up on a reef. The tide had changed and whatever else had happened, and they couldn't get in. The men had to wade ashore a couple hundred yards offshore, had to wade to get on the island.
And a lot of them didn't get on the island. They got mowed down trying to get there.
A lot didn't get there. And so now we're going to bypass that action. We're going to go in the back way into the lagoon. And we'll have aerial guys from the 25th Marines going. We were the 24th. From the 25th Marines going to set up artillery on these little islets to kind of support us as we came in the back way. Well, you're aboard the USTs, and we had to put camouflage paint on and all that business, and we did. Then we got aboard the LVTs. Now we were supposed to leave at 10 o'clock. But it takes time to get LVTs off. Then once they're lined up, then the commanders go, and you go towards the island. That way, everybody is on the island pretty much at the same time. So we got on the island, and we had a young guy from Champaign, Illinois, who was bet by some hot shot in his class that he could get in the Marine Corps and Frank couldn't. Frank was so naive, he said, I bet him. He said, I got in the Marine Corps, and he didn't. Plus the fact I didn't get the $50. And that's the kind of gullibility. I mean, and a super smart kid. I think they claim he had the highest IQ in the division. But anyway, we land. Someone said, where's Frank? I said, I don't know. He's probably behind somewhere. I said, I'll go back and check. And I went back to check. And Frank was in a hole in his helmet. He was dead. And there he was sitting there. He's the first casualty that I saw. And, you know, that leaves the mark on you that, well, you know, when someone says, sniper, be awake, be alert, there's probably somebody who, you know, doing something. So we went through the moor. We got down through a clearing. And I was a bazooka man. And firing these rockets. I had never fired a rocket before because you don't expend the ammunition and all that. You go through the dry runs. So the officer said there was a house and a spotlight, a searchlight, and he said, see if you can hit the house. You know, see if you can. So I aimed and hit the house and blew it up. And when that happens, this is different now than being trained. Now see what you can do when you do it. That kind of gives us some enthusiasm. Now you become almost like a showboat. Boy, I'm glad I can hit that house. And then he said, there was a Japanese getting up on top of a revetment. He said, O'Brien, you hit the Japanese and I'll kiss your eyes. And I thought that was an interesting challenge. So I aimed. And what happens with the Zuka tube, it's just a pipe. As it gets hot from the propellant in the rocket, you're almost aiming at the ground because it'll take off on you. I was aiming at the ground and apparently hit the Japanese, and he's on my back, banging on my shoulder, just like you scored a touchdown. Hooray, hooray, on this. So now we thought we were going to take over the island. So Al Prusik, the officer, and Norrie Savage, just a guy like I was, the three of us take off to the revetment. And as we got there, our machine gunners opened fire on the revetment. At the same time, the Japanese in the revetment opened fire. So now we're on our back watching all these tracer bullets go by, because between each tracer, there's probably three or four regular bullets. And we watched that for about a half an hour. It was thrilling. It was neat. It was something we hadn't done before. Now they ceased firing. So I got up first, and I led the bunch out, and I'm running down. And I kind of made a half turn to my left. And as I did, I felt like I got hit in the apoplectic of your body. And I kind of lost my breath. I kept running, got down into the hole. And my little finger on my left hand was just hanging off, just like a chicken wing had been broken. It wasn't bleeding, it wasn't hurting, but it looked kind of strange. Prusik, the officer, came in, and I said, I've been hit. He said, you haven't been. I said, look at that finger. Hey, damn if you haven't. So for the first time, I had seen a first aid packet open up. And all a first aid packet was a piece of Kotex about 4 or 5 inches long, with about 72 yards of cotton bandage, and miserable. You try putting that on a finger that's hanging out, and it doesn't do much. Now, I just casually put my hand up under my dungaree jacket, and man, it was a warm hole, and I thought, wow, what's that? And at that time, it's amazing. I couldn't speak. I couldn't talk. And Prusik wanted to give me some water. And I remember an old movie where Edward G. Robinson, I think it was, got raked by a machine gun. He had taken a drink of water and he was trying to plug up the holes with his fingers as the water was coming out. And I said, I don't want water. You know, let me alone. About that time, a very good friend of mine, D.B. Kellenberger, came to the top of the hole and looked down at me. We had no communication. We had no phones. We had no cell phone. We had nothing. So DB took his jacket off. I can still see him now. Took his helmet off. And we had been aboard ship for quite a while. So we were tan. We looked like we were Japanese, I suppose. And DB went running back to get some help for me. And while doing that, one of our guys, friendly fire, shot, and he later on died.
Oh.
And here was a guy who was, DB was at Pearl Harbor on December the 7th. And he was up all day. Then he got assigned to guard duty that night, and while on guard duty, fell asleep and got caught. I think he got a general court-martial. He was going to put him in the brig forever, I suppose. And then later on, they cleaned the brig out and sent DB to the 4th Marine Division. And DB's brag to fame was he was the oldest private in the Marine Corps, because he couldn't be promoted, and there he was. And yet DB was, I mean, just a delightful guy. He used to impersonate W.C. Fields. He never wore a belt on his dungarees. He used to tie it up with a shoestring. Why, I don't know. And we used to play cards aboard the ship. And we always won. I don't know how we did that, but we did. Here he was. He dies going to get help for me, you know, a guy that he had just met. So, I mean, you know, it's that kind of stuff that makes you wonder, you know, what a war is all about.
So you're 20 years old. You're hit in the chest and your fingers hanging off. And this was your first experience in combat, period.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's not very encouraging. Take me from there. How did you deal with that situation?
Well, you know, in reading about our division was one of the probably youngest divisions in the Marine Corps. We went through 4 major battles, which means 4 major landings. Wound up with probably, I guess, 20% were casualties. You know, you've got about 20,000 guys in the division, but a lot of them are mechanics or paper. They're cooks or some other things. They're not combat men. They're not out in the field, but out there shooting and being shot at.
That percentage was a lot different for the guys who were doing what you were doing.
I mean, and that kind of campers, which way you're trying to talk.
How much pain were you in?
It's interesting. I had no pain.
Huh.
I had no pain. They sent some guys up as stretcher bearers. And these were usually band men or cooks or something. And they came up. They didn't have a stretcher, so he had to improvise a stretcher. Well, then they couldn't lift me.
You were one of the bigger guys, huh?
So they couldn't lift me, so they dragged me through all these holes over to the beach. And again, honestly, nothing hurt.
Were you scared?
I wasn't bleeding, and I was still conscious. I knew what was going on. And we got down to the evacuation center. I remember the guy saying, "Where's the hospital ship?" Well, there were about 9 transports out there. It's out there. We went out, we'd bump into a ship, and it's just the hospital ship. Says, "No, try T-boats over." And we kept going. Finally, we got to a hospital ship. They lowered this thing down and hooked up my stretcher and picked me up and put me aboard the ship. And the first thing they did was take your valuables. And I think I had a New Testament and something else in the pocket, and they put that on my chest. Well, then they took all my clothes off and put my valuables on my chest. Took me to the mess room where the cooks had been and all that business, and laid me on the table. And then they started asking, "How did it happen?" "How do I know how it happened? Some guy shot me." "Well, where did it go?" I said, "I have no idea." So they rolled me over and finally found there was a hole about the size of a little finger just above my hip. That was the entry. It came out by my navel. Uh-huh. And left about a 4x4 hole. Ooh. And there it was. And
how many vital organs did that thing
hit? Yeah, I mean, it didn't hit anything. It didn't hit a thing.
Isn't that miraculous?
It is a miracle. Yeah, I mean, and I remember one of the doctors who had been at Mayo Clinic. He said, "Oh, Brian, you're in such good shape. The bullet took the course of least resistance. I'd give me a break."
How long did it take you to recover before you went back?
I went back in the end of May, and the wounds happened on the 2nd or 3rd of February.
So that's 3 months.
But I was ambulatory.
Yeah.
I was walking.
During that time, were you ever scared or concerned that you weren't going to make it?
I wasn't scared of that, but you know where proud flesh is?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, in the wound, right from the center of it, proud flesh started developing. And I was puffing up. I had the illusions. Maybe the shell is still in there, and it hasn't gone off yet.
That would get your attention, sure.
Yeah, and I, you know, and I kept watching this thing. And finally, a doctor came in. He was the guy from Mayo Clinic. She grabbed the pair of clippers and clipped off the proud flesh, and that was it. And never, it didn't hurt. And and of course, it disappeared. It didn't come back.
What about your finger?
And the finger was, I guess I finally, you know, I could move it. And, of course, that gives you something else you can do. You can move the finger. And I don't have any stitches I had in there. But I remember when they cut it off, my first question was, "This won't put me out of the Marine Corps, will it?" The doctors assured me it wouldn't.
No, it didn't keep him from continuing to fight. In fact, he was wounded again in the capture of Tinian. It also didn't stop him from playing college football for Dartmouth after the war, or the accomplishment he was most proud of, becoming the father of 14 children. It's time for our first break, but when this special Purple Heart edition of Hometown Heroes continues, a soldier whose injuries had him left for dead in the Korean War. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of National Purple Heart Day, which lands on August 7th every year. Over the years, we've heard from dozens of Purple Heart recipients here on Hometown Heroes. Sometimes the survival stories seem a little more improbable than others. And that was the case almost 75 years ago on August 5th, 1950, near the 38th parallel in Korea for a young member of the 1st Cavalry Division named Tom Davis.
We got up in the morning. They said, we're going to move out. And I said, where are we going? They said, well, we're going to go over here to another location and take over the hill. And I said, oh. And so we went out on a long march and start marching. And we got to the top of the hill and started to go down the other side, and we're in single file, and the very last guy in the group, there was probably 200 of us, 200 at least hit the hill originally, but I don't know where the other 100 came from, because it seems to me that it was about 100 in our group, and the last guy on the hill was shot, and he went down. So I said, we're in enemy territory. We got down to the bottom of the hill. There's a river down there, and it wasn't much of a river, and I don't know whether it was a big river or not at one time. It wasn't much water in it. We could walk across it, I'd say maybe 2 feet deep at the most. And I got out in the middle of it, and I heard an explosion. I looked down at my right, and there was a bomb that went off in the water. It came from them. They shot, it wasn't a mortar. It's very similar to a mortar, does the same thing, except it shows you where it lands. In other words, it was a flare type of thing. It went up in the air, and then went at that end of the, about, I'd say, 200 feet from us, and another one went off above it, and they both hit in the water, in the river. And I said, do you see that? And the guy said, what are you talking about? And I said, do you see those two hit? And he said, no, I didn't pay any attention to it. I said, well, that just told you they had it zeroed in, because it's got this river zeroed in. I said, so if we try to come back out of there, they're going to get us. I said, you got to remember that. And so I forgot about it, you know, because when you get in a firefight, you don't remember a lot of things. But when I did get back, I found out where I almost got to that river when I got hit with a mortar, and it blew me up into a tree, and I had a broken leg and shrapnel in my back and shrapnel in my both arms, and my thigh was almost shot off, and I was laying on the ground, and I was going to heaven.
So as you experienced it, what were you doing when you got hit? What were the moments right before you got hit like?
Well, what happens, we took the hill away from the enemy, as we did, we took over their entire hill there, and we went up to the top of it and got to the, ran them off, and then they had bunkers all around there, and so I climbed into one of the bunkers, and I remembered all the stories when I was in training. Do not pick up any enemy's ammunition, period, because it might be booby-trapped. And so it was full of ammunition on the ground there on where I was in. And I said, I'm not touching it. So I was in there, and all of a sudden I looked up, and the guy running by me says, get the hell out of here, Tom. And I said, okay, we're going home, go getting out. So I took off, and I was running down the hill, and I must have got hit at that point almost halfway. I was almost down at the bottom when a mortar hit me and blew me up into the tree, and it's actually, when I say a tree, it was probably a good sized brush, you know, and that was just hung up in that thing. When I came, I was going to heaven, on my way to heaven, and I could see myself going to the pearly gates and everything else, but they didn't open them for me and sent me back. And so I came to, and I said, oh my God, I'm alive. So I yanked and pulled my leg out and crawled off the hill. And there was 200 of us when we went on that hill, and there was only one person down left. So I'm thinking that when I crawled off the hill, I came around the corner, and the guy said, oh, my God, Tom, we left you for dead. And I said, well, I'm not dead. And he said, and I grabbed a hold of him, and he helped me. And there was one tank. We had was six tanks when we first went into attack. And there were six tanks that were out there shooting overhead fire while we were taking the hill over. And there was only one tank left, and they said they saw us trying to carry me, and they sent five more guys out with a litter, put me on that, and put me on top of the tank, and drove me back to a safe zone where they started to take my clothes all off, slowly cut them off, and find out where the wounds are, and start to take care of me there. And I told him, I said, don't cut them off. I said, give them to somebody else. It's too damn cold here. I said, I had two pairs of pants on. He said, well, Tom, they're all shot to hell anyway, so I wouldn't worry about where they go. He said, so we're just going to cut them off. But I didn't know that at the time. I couldn't figure out why I wasn't bleeding. And the guy says, you would have bled to death if it had been warmer. And it was so cold that that's the only reason I didn't bleed to death. The blood wasn't circulating. It was so cold. And so I was lucky that way. But it didn't take long that when I was in, they put me in on a truck and took me over to a tent hospital. And put me in a tent hospital. And I looked down and I said, I thought, my God, I hope he had a good dinner. Looked like he took the whole thigh off on one side. And it was pretty badly torn up. My back was pretty sore, and I didn't know how bad it was. But it was wounded in the back, too, and both arms and hand. I started seeing little pieces of me. That was stripped nude. They had me stripped nude in this hospital room there. And I could see all these bloody places all over me. It was kind of crazy looking. But I said, give me some more morphine. And they gave me a little bit more, and they said, you've had plenty, so don't worry about it. But anyway, I was a lot of pain by now. That was the pain started coming on. I didn't have any pain at the beginning of it, but it was so cold, I guess. That's Mother Nature takes care of you when that takes place.
Could you feel the impact of that mortar blast, or were you just knocked out immediately?
I was out immediately. I mean, I felt nothing. I felt I was on my way to heaven, and this is the honest to God truth, because I felt that I was on my way, and it was a sort of a long white trail, and just heading up that way, and all of a sudden somebody says, I can't come in. And so I had to go back. And so I know there's a God, and so I know there's a God, and I know there's something in the next world that I'm going to see when I go. I'm going to see it because I know there's something there that I didn't get to see. And I came back, and the first thing my eyes opened up, I said, oh, my God, I'm alive. I thought I was dead all the time. I experienced death, and it was kind of an very interesting. It was peaceful. I didn't have any pain at all. I didn't have any pain until I came to, and I didn't even have any pain until I crawled off the hill, and until the guy picked me up and tried to help me get going. Then the pain came, because the leg was killing me, and the pain started coming, and I just collapsed. I mean, I couldn't go anymore. I mean, I couldn't help myself. And it was kind of crazy, and I didn't have any pain until then. And I didn't see any blood on me or anything like that, but they said that I'd have bled to death, they said, if it was warmer.
So when you come to, I mean, how do you make sense of the reality that you're in? I mean, you don't know if there's enemy out there, if your guys are around. What's that process like when you come to and you're trying to figure out what's going on?
Well, the first thing I did was when I come to, I got to get out of this mess I'm in, you know. And I started crawling down the hill, and I knew I got to get back to that river, as I remembered. So I was crawling right for that, and I was trying to head for the tanks that I remember seeing when I was in combat, when the fighting started and tanks were shooting overhead fire. There were six tanks out there, and I knew that they were there, and so I got to crawl that, and that'd be my only way out of here, because I couldn't, there wasn't anybody else around. And I came around the corner there, and here the guy said, oh my God, we left you for dead. And I said, I'm not dead. So I put my arm around him, and he tries to, we walk across the creek, river there, and we got it on the other side, and then I collapsed on the other side, and he says, get up. And I said, I can't get up, I can't walk on the leg. And he couldn't carry me, so I looked up, and I see these guys coming running from the tank, and they have a litter in their hands, and they got over there, and they put me on the litter and hauled me all the way back to the tank, and then put me on top of the tank, and I don't even remember getting off the tank or where the tank went when I passed out when I was on top of the tank, I guess. And the next thing I know, I was laying on the ground, and there was about 8 or 10 guys laying there, wounded too, right alongside of me, you know, and they're cutting my clothes off. And I said, well, how bad is it? And he said, oh, it's not bad at all. I said, you mean I got to come back? And he says, no, you're not coming back. You got a stateside wound. And I said, wow. I couldn't believe that, you know, because a lot of guys had to come back sometimes to get wounded in the foot or something like that, and then they'd just fix him up and they'd bring him back out the field again. They'd shoot, and he'd be out there getting himself shot again. And it's not fun to have to come back to combat zone and experience it again. Not exciting at all. It's scary. And I don't wish that on anybody.
I don't know if you've ever thought about this. What do you think would have happened to you if that guy wasn't there, if he didn't see you and help you as far as he did?
You asked that question, and I know what I felt, that if I hadn't have been, I'd have crawled as far as I could gone, but I know damn well I would have probably been killed by the enemy. They would have found me, and because I couldn't have crawled across the field that far. It was a good quarter of a mile to the tank, and they wouldn't have seen me crawling on the ground, because I was just crawling. When I got to the creek, that's when he was. There was 200 of us there, and then he was the only one left, and there was only one guy left, and he hadn't gone across the creek yet. He saw me coming around the corner there, crawling on the ground, and I was crawling as fast as I could crawl, and I probably would have died by the time I got to the tank. Because it was another quarter of a mile away, and they wouldn't have seen me crawling across the field in that brush. It was rice paddies. It was what it was across there. I had to get through. But I thought about it several times. If I hadn't have found somebody there, that I probably would have been killed by the enemy.
Or even if it took you 5 or 10 minutes longer to come to, by that time, all those guys would have been gone.
Yes, he would have been gone. Everybody was gone. There was only one guy left, and he was straggler, and he was ready to cross the creek when he saw me.
Do you remember that guy's name, the guy who found you?
You know, I don't know who he was, and I wished I did. It was hard to recognize anything at that time. It was very difficult. I couldn't see how badly I was wounded because I was sort of still delirious. It was tough.
And you'd been there 3 months by now. So had you dealt with losing friends of yours, losing guys that you had served with?
Oh, yes. One of the guys was in my basic training. I asked him where he was, and they said he got killed yesterday. And I said, oh, no, my God. Somebody's got to call his parents and let them know. It was very disturbing because I went through basic training with him, and he was in combat, and he hadn't been there long enough to even know what the hell the war was all about, you know, and he was killed. It was sad to see somebody get hurt. There's not much you can do, though. I mean, you do the best you can do and try to hang on. I know I made some decisions that I tried to stay alive. That was the main thing I tried to do, but it was tough. It was damn tough. No one knows how tough it is until you're right into that combat. And the enemy doesn't care, and he's going after you. So you've got to be on your toes, or otherwise you're going to be killed. I mean, I don't know how anybody makes it through the damn thing.
Well, and you said you're convinced you would have died had that soldier not been there right when you crawled to that point. And I guess the likelihood is your body might still be over there, because there are thousands of American servicemen who their remains have not been brought home yet from that war yet, and people are still working on that. But what I wonder is, when you're in the hospital, when you're starting to take stock of your wounds, was there any fear or concern in your mind that you might not make it, or that your life would be drastically impacted by these injuries?
Once I got wounded, you know, you're in a tent hospital. I was in and out because I was doped up quite a bit, so I didn't have much of a remembrance of that because I was unconscious and out of it. But when they put me on the train and shipped me down to Seoul, there was other soldiers on that train. And I know I was on the bottom bunk, and the guy above me was there, and we were talking to each other. I said, I hope the hell I don't have to come back. And he said, I don't want to come back. That's no fun up here. And so when I got back to Seoul, I go to the hospital. They take us in. They carry me in on a litter, and they open the door. And from the beginning of the hospital door to the far end, as far as I could see, there was bodies on the floor, just hundreds of them. They were waiting to get in to see a doctor, and that's where I was placed. I fall asleep again. The next thing you know, somebody's waking me up into the operating room. That must be midnight or so. And I had, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. It was the oddest thing to have. I had all my clothes taken off, and then that was wrapped up in blankets and stuff. But I had my hand, and I had my wallet in my hand. We only made $3 a day when you get $90 a month and something like that. And you get in combat, they give you combat pay, $50 a month of combat pay extra. So I had a $100 bill in my wallet, and I had my wallet in my hand, and I put it there. And the doctor, I can remember this day, he says, can I have that wallet? And I said, no, And I would not give it to him, you know. And he said, it's okay. That's no problem. And then I wake up after this, the surgery and everything else, and I had a cast on my leg. I felt my chest. My wallet's taped to my chest. I said, oh, what a fool you were. They took it away while I was out, and then they put it back on and taped it to me. It was so funny to find my wallet was taped to my chest with all the shrapnel they took out of me. And he said, the doctor walked by, and he says, boy, I didn't know they used shotguns over there. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you hit everywhere. And I said, well, it doesn't feel good today. It was better. I had a cast on my leg and everything else, but it was kind of strange. And then they package you all up again on the cast. They mark where your wounds are, because you're not going to stay there in that hospital, because that's all that hospital's for, is to take the patients in and get them out as fast as possible, because they're getting them in by the day, hundreds of them coming in. So they had to get me out and fly me to Japan. And I didn't know it at the time, but they mark on the cast there where the wounds are, so the next doctor can look at the cast and say, okay, there's a wound down here, goes through his leg and so forth. But anyway, they fly me to Kobe, Japan, and I go to the hospital there, and the Japanese nurse is there, but they also had an American nurse who was in charge of all the Japanese nurses. But they come in every day, and I had wet soaks on me all the way around. They put and fill with salt water, so the wounds would sort of fill back in again, but my temperature wouldn't go down. And the doctor kept coming in and says, what are you eating? And I said, why? And he said, well, your temperature won't go down. You must be eating something that's not agreeing with you or something, you know. And I said, no, I'm not eating anything I'm not agreeing with it. That was about 3 days, I think maybe 3 or 4 days before they decided they better cut the cast off and see if there's anything there. Well, you can't blame the doctors in combat, you know. They do the best they can with what they got to work with, as quick as they can, you know. So when they put a cast on my leg, they marked that where the shrapnel went through my bone, and they marked that circle, but they didn't mark the shrapnel that went into my foot. And so when they cut the cast off, the pus just went everywhere. And they said, oh my God, he's got another wound somewhere. And so that's why he's having so much trouble. Every day they'd have to take the cast off and drain that wound down there, you know. And the Japanese nurses were sort of dainty. They didn't want to hurt you, and they'd be just as dainty as they possibly could, but it's still painful. And so they squeeze it and, you know, and let the, it was terrible. Anyway, maybe 5 days went by, and one day came by, and I said, oh man, they forgot me. I get to get by today without, they won't be doing this, because it was painful to have them do that, you know. And about noon, the pain was starting to throb, and the foot was starting to really go to hell. And so I had to pull the buzzer, and the head nurse was an American, and she was in charge of all the Japanese nurses. She says, that's your foot, nobody else's foot. And if you don't tell them to take care of it, nobody else is going to take care of it for you. And she grabbed that damn thing, and everybody in the place said, Tom, don't kick her. You know, I mean, she was just mad in hell at me. She went, bam, she was, what the hell's that? And I said, what do you mean? She said, what popped out? It looks like part of your boot. She pops this part of my boot out of my heel that was in there, and the infection was in there, and then it was just running all over the place. And she says, well, my God. She said, maybe we got it all out of there now, and it's going to start to heal. And it did. It started healing from then. I was there 3 months before I could leave that area to come home. And they couldn't let me go unless they got the infection all out, you know. But they didn't know what was causing it until she got mad at me, and she just squeezed so hard, tired. And I mean, I was almost going to kick her. Once that came out, then things started to heal, so then they could package me up and ship me out of there and send me home.
I don't know about you, but hearing what wounded veterans have endured on our behalf gives me a whole new perspective on the freedom we all get to enjoy. It's time for our final break, but another unforgettable survival story will cap off this special Purple Heart edition of Hometown Heroes right after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake.
Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring all of our wounded veterans in the wake of National Purple Heart Day. I feel obligated to mention that over the years, we've also encountered many veterans who never received the Purple Heart for their wounds. And every once in a while, those discrepancies are reconciled. So far today, we've heard from a Purple Heart Marine, another wounded veteran from the Army. Over the years, plenty of Army Air Corps and Air Force Purple Heart recipients have shared their stories. We've heard from Coast Guardsmen. And today, we're going to wrap up with the story of how a Navy veteran earned his Purple Heart aboard the aircraft carrier USS Hornet. Bob Cole had been aboard the Hornet when Jimmy Doolittle and his Raiders took off for their unprecedented raid on Tokyo. He was still on the ship 6 months later when it was sunk in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands.
My job during the battle is we were on the second floor in the forward mess hall, and what we did was put the bomb, the vanes and fuses on the bombs and send them up to the hangar deck or flight deck. This is on the second deck in the forward mess hall. There were 35 of us down there in that mess hall, and we tripped up the elevator as fast as we could. And what happened, the bombers, Japanese bombers, came off the island of Guadalcanal, which they own, and they just kept bombing us. And we didn't have kamikazes hit us. They hit right at the flight deck and hit where the motors and all that, the control tower is. And one of the bombs came right down the elevator where we were and exploded. And the shrapnel from the mess tables hit me right in the eye, right here. And they cut my eye down, lowered my eye down, so I lost my eye, my vision and everything else. And we lost the elevator. And out of that 35, only 12 of us came out alive. I don't know why. And then all of a sudden, we over the loudspeaker, it says, abandoned ship. And how in the world were we going to get up there? So we crawled up the ladders to the hangar deck, and then we had to jump into the water. And I happened to find a towel to hold my eye up like this, because it was just laying down by the skin underneath here and an optic nerve that held it from just going out altogether. And I had two big holes in my back from the shrapnel. So we abandoned ship, and I stayed in the water for about 45 minutes to an hour before I was rescued, because, you know, all the people were abandoning. The destroyer Mustin came up and picked me up. Then they took me into the dressing room, and they sewed my eye up with no anesthetic, so I was in such a shock. From there, they took me to the French island called Noumea. Also, we had a hospital ship, Solace, S-O-L-A-C-E, and I was put aboard there, and that's when they were determining what to do with my eye. They weren't worried about my back, and my back hurt more than the eye. But 3 days on board the ship, hospital ship, there was a cargo ship going back to San Diego, so we drew straws who was going to go back. I happened to draw a good straw. There were some married couples there, married people wanted to go. He said, I'll give you $5,000 for that. I said, well, I'll never see you again, buddy. I may be dumb, but I'm not stupid. So I went back to, but took us about, I think it was 2 weeks or so before we got to San Diego. And then we put in the San Diego Naval Hospital, and I stayed there for almost 8 months. My parents were given a letter saying I was a MIA, you know, missing in action, because nobody knew where we were, you know, everything's in uproar.
Man, there's so many questions about this. I didn't want to interrupt you because it's so captivating, the story that you told. But I'm going to backtrack with you and kind of take you through some of those steps along the way. So at the time that you guys got hit, you were on that second deck putting fuses on bombs?
Yeah, putting a fuse and bomb and vanes on the bomb. And then we'd ship them up in the elevator to the hangar deck or flight deck, probably the hangar deck first, because they couldn't put the planes on the hangar deck up to the flight deck until the planes on the flight deck took off. And then
all of a sudden this explosion happens.
Bomb came right down the elevator, which we used to go up and down and ship the bombs, and they exploded. And happened to be in the Ford mess hall. The tables are all aluminum or something like that, and they just scattered and then shrapnel hit all of us.
So all of the explosive material and shrapnel within the bomb was added to by all this metal material inside the room. I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes and understand what that felt like, because, I mean, this is sudden and intense, I imagine. What did it feel like?
You know, I was in shock. Looking around and also seeing how, you know, we told to abandon ship, find out where the ladder was, because, I'm not normal. And then seeing some of my good friends dead and find out where the other ones who were not dead, so we all could go up, you know, one at a time, the ladder. And it's, you know, it's chaos.
And your left eye is hanging out of the socket, just hanging on by a thread.
By the skin underneath and one optic nerve there.
You're wounded in the back.
When they took the shrapnel out of the holes in the back, whatever the utensils they use, they could see my rib. Yeah.
You had to be in a lot of pain.
Oh, well, when you're in shock, you don't know what I was in pain, very much so. Then I had to jump in the water.
Well, you had to get up to where you can jump in the water first. And
also, I had to find a life jacket.
And you probably can't see very straight with only one eye.
That's right. Blood is rolling all over the place. There, your camaraderie is great, because people are helping each other. They grabbed me, you know, and led me to where I'm supposed to jump, and we jumped together so I wouldn't go someplace else.
That's not a jump in a wading pool.
They say it's around between 40 and 60 feet. And thank God I wasn't on the flight deck. So that's higher up.
Yeah. Did you have to hold your eye in while you jumped?
I did, because I had a towel. I found a towel when I was there, or some guy might have found it for me. And I lift my eye back up and then hold the towel like that and held it all the time I was there. And they said, make sure when you do get in the water, make sure you float on your back, because your back has more protection than your stomach does. Your stomach is just so fat.
And this may sound like a dumb question or a dumb series of questions. Were you scared? Did you think you were going to die?
Very scared, very scared. You know, I've never been through anything like that. I'm a little farm boy. Never even had guns around our house or anything like that, so I don't think about you talking about a life lesson. I probably learned more the 4 years I was in the Navy than I learned 4 years in college about life. I'm not talking about books now. I'm talking about life. I learned everything. I learned things I never even envisioned I'd ever know, you know, or have to do. I'm not the only one, you know.
The phrase trial by fire takes on new meaning when we hear a story like yours. So you've gotten out of the fire, out of this sinking ship, but now you're in the water. And there are all kinds of things to worry about in the water. How long were you in the water?
Anywhere from about 45 minutes to an hour.
How long did it feel like?
Eternity. But I looked around and I said, I'm not here by myself. That's the best part of it. If I had to be there by myself, might have just turned over and said, the heck with it.
How many did you have with there? Do you remember any of them?
On our ship, because there's a lot of ships out there picking up people out of the water. I would say it was about 20 in my particular area.
Did you have anything to help you stay afloat?
Yeah, your life jacket, that's all. That's all. And, you know, you paddle, dog paddle or something like that.
How great did that feel to get picked up out of that water?
I thought they were never coming. Look, there's, 3,000 people in the water. Count the other ships and all that people. How can they handle so many people? I thought, well, when I saw that ship coming towards us, we all hollered, hey, over here, over here. You know, you've seen that on TV, haven't you? Uh-huh. Hey, over here, I'm over here.
Best thing you ever saw?
Oh, man. Better than ice cream.
You talked about being in shock when that bomb hit and you're hit in the back and your eyes hanging out. When did that shock wear off and when did you realize what had happened to you?
I think the shock wore off was when I was on board the hospital ship Solis. They had, more trained doctors. Because when you're on board, like that destroyer, and you're moving and you're the guy operator, you know, he's trying to do the best he can, but you're still under fire and you're moving. And so when I was aboard the Solis, the hospital ship, you know, they're standing still. They're not moving. In fact, they wanted to take my eye out and give me a glass eye. Thank God that cargo ship came along. Because what am I going to say? But they know more medically than I do. And so I figured whatever they say is going to happen. So I was very fortunate that I still have my same eye, but little by little, I can distinguish day and night. And once in a while, I can see a hand, but if you put one or two or three, I would never see that. So
you see fine out of your right eye, but the left eye has never been the same since.
No, and the right eye that's why I go to the Veterans Hospital here every 4 months, and they give me, I put drops in my eye, and DMV wants 20/40, but the best I can get is 20/50. And the DMV say, that's good enough for me. Uh-huh. So far.
Well, I know you covered a lot of miles all those years of refereeing basketball, and that I have to go there because it's just it's too ripe for the picking. What is the biggest criticism about referees every year, that they need glasses or they can't see? Did you ever have some people heckle you about your basketball reffing?
I said, hey, I got both eyes, but I only see out of one. And then a lot of times they razz you, and then I might say, I'm laughing all the way to the bank.
If they only knew what that eye had been through, it would be heaping coals on top of their heads, I'm sure.
Most of the coaches, you know, we might meet at the bar, and we have good times. And I remember one time when I met at the bar, and I put my glasses on, and this coach's wife says, why in the hell didn't you put those glasses on while you're refereeing? I said, I might have seen too much, and it caused the game to go longer.
Yeah, we don't want that whistle blowing too much. So you said, was it 8 months in the hospital?
8 months. There's a comic side of that, too, you know, because I had both eyes covered all the time because they didn't want to have the strain on one eye. But if you wanted liberty whenever you're able, you had to do one or two things. You either polish all the brass in your area or go to the zoo and clean out the zoo pens. I said, well, I'm not going to the zoo. I've been in the zoo all my life. Out in that water, that's the zoo. So I didn't go much liberty. No, either that or I just polished the brass.
8 months is a long time, and your back's healing up, your eyes healing up. What was the hardest thing for you to deal with?
Well, I told you before this, you know, I never had a chance to call my mother to let her know where I am because I knew I was listed as MIA. When I was able to get to the phone, when they allowed me to use the phone, I called my mom and told her, she's in shock because she hadn't heard anything about it from me.
She thought you were dead.
Yeah. In fact, they had a funeral for me. That was before I called her. And I called her and she's, oh, God.
Not too many of us can say we survived our own funeral, much less lived another 80 years afterwards. Again, that was USS Hornet survivor Bob Cole. And let's conclude today with something to ponder. Do you know any Purple Heart recipients? If so, have you ever heard their stories? Maybe it's time to start asking. Thanks for spending this hour with us today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again of something that every Purple Heart recipient understands more deeply than we ever could. Freedom is not free.